everything, and I'd like to say that let's all give him an applause. Now, the fact that I'm speaking now is a complete joke foisted upon me by Rob Myers. I know nothing about this subject virtually. I certainly, when Petter's paper came out, I thought, wow, that looks interesting. And I kind of read through it quickly and went back to everything else I was trying to do. And so then, you know, an eruption of papers emerged and it became even more hopeless. So then when I heard about this workshop happening, I thought, great, here's my chance to try to find out basically what's going on. I feel like I've found out basically what's going on, which is great. But now I'm supposed to tell you about it, which is kind of crazy. So I've been trying desperately to understand, and I'll just say a few things about what we heard as I understood it, some disagreements as I understood them, and just a couple of my own thoughts about the subject. Okay. So the first thing is there's a dizzying array of alternatives. There's like 2 to the n versions of the theory, and n keeps growing. So let me just make a list. Projectable versus non-projectable. Okay, it's one distinction or dichotomy. And then we have, this seems to not really be critical, but are we talking about the detailed balance case or not? Then we have, are we expanding around flat background when we're doing perturbation theory, flat or curved? So that can affect the nature of the modes to a great degree. Are we talking about strong coupling or weak coupling? And in a given regime or scale, is a mode propagating or not propagating? And I guess one more I'll add, are we adding, so this was detailed balance was a question of which terms we're going to consider it to begin with in the action, but even beyond the original meaning of that, according to Diego's talk, are we going to add terms involving the gradient of the lap, so let's say dn over n squared or not? And so you can imagine with all these people working on this with different choices among here and focuses, where it's hard to keep track of what result applies to which case and whether there's actually any disagreement. Whether there's really a choice or whether certain things we are forced to do. But I think I'll leave that board there as a list of alternatives. And I think I want to just start by mentioning, there's no particular order. So I just, the order it came to my mind in cosmology. So just to mention some interesting things, one idea we heard about from two places is that we could get primordial fluctuations without inflation. Without inflation in two very different ways, both having something to do with this collection of ideas from Robert Brandenberger. It comes about through a bounce, which he called the matter bounce. I would call it a Lipschitz bounce, I think, instead of a matter bounce. I think it's maybe a better name. So in this case, scale invariant perturbations, if I understood it right, come about by the following thing. So we have a universe that starts out big, comes to a minimum, and then bounces back out. And as it's accelerating or falling in, modes go outside the horizon and then get their fluctuations are frozen and their amplitude is amplified relative to the vacuum fluctuations. And since the longer wavelength modes left the horizon earlier, they spend more time being amplified, so that while the vacuum spectrum starts out, I guess, blue, it gets lifted up to the red stuff gets lifted up, and it could be scale invariant after the bounce, provided the dynamics of the bounce was appropriate, which meant that, you know, the scale factor had the right time dependence. And apparently, just sort of by accident, if I understood it, with a matter dominated type scale factor evolution, at the time the modes first exited the horizon, you would happen to get a scale invariant spectrum. Is that a correct statement? Okay. So in this case, we get, see if I could summarize that in a world, scale invariance by amplification of, let's say, the longer wavelengths. This is not a really good way to say it, but I sort of, it's a by accident. By accident, scale invariant if matter dominated. So it's always attractive, you know, it's not just an HL gravity, but almost any new gravity theory anybody writes, people like to look at the cosmology of it, because it's so cosmological, it's so cosmic, and it's simpler to the extent that you're looking at homogeneous isotropic things, so it's kind of an attractor of theoreticians' brains, but then people don't necessarily worry enough about other physics that must work out correctly in order for the cosmology to be believable. So there are questions, but anyway, the bounce itself definitely comes about because of properties of the Lipschitz nature, the higher curvature terms. That's interesting. It was pointed out that, I think Rob Myers was asking about this, that Rob Brandenburger seemed to assume that the collapsing phase was very symmetrical, just with vacuum fluctuations on top of it. If you did have any tiny perturbation, there are instabilities. And so, I mean, just the genes instability would grow, and then things are compactifying as the universe shrinks. So that makes it seem like there might be a danger that heading into the bounce, you won't actually have a homogeneous isotropic universe at all. And maybe the whole dynamics of the bounce would be altered in an important way. So certainly one consistency question about a model like this is it really a, is it a fine too finely tuned condition to avoid such growth of structure before the bounce? So as far as I understand, that might be an issue. So on a very completely different approach to getting primordial fluctuations without inflation was Shinji Mukohiyama's idea. And that was that, well, if we have Lorentz violating higher derivative terms in gravity, we should have them in everything, including matter. And so he said we should have some Lipschitz fields which have dispersion relation like this at high enough wave vector. And that means that modes would freeze in a very different way. That is, the effective horizon size for a given mode is not the relativistic one. And by looking at evolution of a mode from a high K to a low K as the universe expands, a mode would exit its effective horizon and then re-enter in a similar way to how it happens in inflationary cosmology. But here it's not on account of going from exponential inflation to a power law, but from the mode itself changing character from omega squared in this non-relativistic dispersion relation to a relativistic one. And in that case, the scale invariance came, again, anybody's work that I characterize, if I say anything incorrect or unfair or anything, please just speak up and correct me. The scale invariance came essentially from the fact that the field that had this dispersion itself was a scale invariant field. It's not like a normal scalar would have mass dimension one, but the scale invariance of the field. So let me just quote Shinji's notes, that phi goes to b to the minus 3 minus z over 2. Phi is the scaling behavior of this field phi. So if z is 3, which corresponds to this case, then phi is dimensionless of scale invariant. So somehow, just from that, the vacuum fluctuations are scale invariant. I think that was basically where it came from. Both of these, you know, so these would be cosmology without inflation. But remember, the original purpose of inflation wasn't even to produce primordial fluctuations, although it's a really good reason for it. But it was to address things like the flatness problem. Well, one of the things being flatness, do these approaches say anything about flatness? Or do we have to go back and fix that separately? I asked Robert about this, and he pointed out that if you imagine that before the bounce, when the universe was, let's say, 10 billion years before the bounce, if the curvature was, spatial curvature, was small then in a sense that naturally accounts for it being small now, because you can just run backward the story. The evolution is just sort of time symmetric if you don't worry about this issue of the perturbation. So in that sense, you don't need a hyper fine tuning of small curvature, say near the bounce. You just need a small-ish curvature way before the bounce. Is that right? So that's okay. In Shinji's approach, I think there's just nothing to be said. There's no mechanism to appeal to get out of the usual worry about flatness.
Yeah. The problem is solved because the speed of light diverges at high temperature and high energy of elliptic.
That sounds reasonable, at least as a first thought. I mean, nobody mentioned looking at
the kind of variance in the class of variable speed of light cosmology.
Right.
If you have a bouncing cosmology, then there is no horizon.
Yeah, then there's no horizon.
That's a point, too. Yeah.
The other one, actually, there's an issue of whether, I looked at this a long time ago, Lorentz violating dispersion to solve the horizon problem. We were very demanding on ourselves when I worked on it because we said, well, we won't accept any solution that involves dipping into the Trans-Planckian regime. But then we showed that you couldn't solve it without dipping into that regime. So that doesn't mean that doesn't solve it. It just means that the theory is not at all under control. So I think it's a very plausible thought. If you have this kind of gravity in the UV, you probably don't have a horizon problem.
So doesn't that depend if it's super or subluminal?
Yes.
So if it's subluminal, you have the same problem.
That's true.
So it has to be a very specific.
Is there any preference, though, in Lipschitz gravity for?
Well, you can always change the properties. I don't know about the detailed balance.
Lipschitz gravity is always superluminal. Sorry.
Why? Why do you know that?
Because just if p goes like p cubed, p cubed to e dp. It's e over m to some power times c. So when e is greater than m, n is the scale of the balance of the dimensions.
Doesn't depend on the sign of a.
E goes like p cubed. No, it's just the EDP is divergence.
Well, I mean.
Am I wrong?
I don't know. If you had omega squared equals k squared minus k to the sixth.
But that doesn't make sense at high energy.
No, eventually it doesn't.
Right.
So if you're going to write something that makes sense in the extreme UV, it better be positive.
Yeah.
So it's super low.
So
do people buy that argument?
There's also the possibility of going to higher values of z. There's no guarantee that z equal to 3 should be the right choice of the anisotropic scaling. In fact, if you want to give a short distance spatial kinetic term to the scalar mode, you may want to be pushed to z equal to 4 just if you require formal power continuity normalizability. And then you could impose discrete symmetries that solve the dangerous part of in the dispersion relation.
Yeah, but the dangerous part is always the highest order. That ultimately,
I'm not saying that
you want to look at, go for, you know, the highest order is the one which tells you this. Effectively, then you could have some like a roton spectrum in Conan's balance, but the highest order tells you if it's effectively super or subluminal. It just shifted to the next order.
So can I make a comment? So about the flatness problem, what's unique about Lefebvre's gravity is that there is a preferred hypersurface. So you could just say that the grounded state of the theory have zero curvature, zero spatial curvature. And of course, that needs to be demonstrated for if you know the fundamental theory. But if you could prove that the grounded state has zero spatial curvature, then that's your solution. And that's unique about this Lefebvre's gravity, because in ordinary GR, there is no preferred foliation. So it doesn't make sense to make that statement is meaningless in GR. But in Lefebvre's gravity, it's meaningful because there is a preferred foliation. If grounded state has zero curvature, then that's the answer.
I actually have a tiny comment on what Niyaj just said. I mentioned this attempt to add a U1 gauge symmetry to make sure that the number of gauge symmetries locally is the same as in GR. And I mentioned in the talk how it works only in 2+1 dimensions, at least in the simplest way we tried it. It's actually quite interesting in that case. The extra field imposes an equation of motion which is precisely saying that the spatial curvature has to vanish. And you cannot turn on a non-trivial spatial curvature constant term, like the spatial annul of the cosmological constant, because it's not gauge invariant under this U1. So in that case, there is just no issue with the... But of course, that's just a baby example in 2+1 dimensions. I'm not saying I know how to make that same thing happen in high dimensions.
But surely, I mean, it would be too much to have spatial curvature on any... So in any space-time, there's going to be a preferred foliation.
Yes.
You need to have space-times with planets and stars.
Sure.
Those won't... The kind of geometry we observe won't presumably admit.
But this is the high energy. This is the high energy or high temperature grounded state. At lower temperature,
okay,
that should be broken, of course.
Okay.
Otherwise,
so you
wouldn't have
feel to that in the early universe.
Yeah.
You have to be really near that ground state with small, very very small fluctuations around it.
But I mean, this is like ordinary spontaneous symmetry breaking. That like at high energies, you are in the most symmetric phase. Let us say low energies, you break symmetry. So that same thing could be something like that.
Yeah, just so you have to be really near that ground state. Okay. Let me see. I'll move to a different subject now, not cosmology. So there's a question of whether the theory is stable perturbing around something. And the question arises, perturbing around what? And which theory, of course?
So, Ted, would you mind if we call us the projectability in the two things? Because I think they are different, no? So
right.
It was non-projectable and changing was projectable, right?
Oh, actually, good point. In this, at this stage, actually, I don't think this idea is really
the matter bounds,
tied to whether it's...
That's completely independent.
It's independent.
A completely independent.
Okay, sorry.
The matter bounds is in Shinji's cosmological idea. It's not depend on a projectability or not. That comes up later.
Okay, sorry.
But no, please feel... So, stability about backgrounds So first of all, I guess around a flat background, there are in general some instabilities. See if I can remember. So if we have the projectable case, to be specific, so projectable about flat space, has an unstable, I guess it's called scalar graviton or something. Scalar mode, let's say. Right, so that sounds bad. So how can that be responded to? Well, maybe not the projectable, maybe not flat space, maybe higher curvature terms in the action change this. I think we have pretty flat space in this room, okay? So we need to have a stable room, and the Hubble constant can't matter. So even if there's stability in some about some cosmological solution, which has been demonstrated for some cases, I don't see that that helps us in the room. It doesn't matter what the Hubble constant is here. We don't feel the Hubble flow. You might say, well, we feel the Earth's gravitational field, so let's maybe we should be checking stability perturbing around the field of the Earth. And of course, I'm not even sure that's the right thing to do, because just there must be regions of space where I don't really have a particular body's field to worry about. And just I have wavelengths short enough that I could ignore any inhomogeneities in the field, and it should be stable around flat space. It seems to me, it makes me very nervous to consider a theory that doesn't have that kind of appeal to some special properties of perturbing around special solutions. So that seems like a problem unless you have a theory that doesn't have this instability. Now, let's see how to get rid of it. One way was to add these extra terms I mentioned, the gradient of the lapse, and according to Diego's talk, this actually can stabilize.
This is for non-projectable.
For non-project, yeah, thank you.
The canceling.
Right. So that might be good. I want to mention another thing about perturbing around the background. Shinji said something shocking for the projectable case. So let's see, projectable. This is not very organized. I'm sorry about that. I just had to try to barely understood enough to not make a complete fool of myself. The projectable case, according to Shinji, there are no static stars or planets or anything. Okay. So let me restate this argument, and Shinji, correct me if I say something wrong. So the point here is that if it's projectable, then the lapse is a function just of one coordinate. And this means that that the gradient of that coordinate divided by its norm is a unit vector UA, unit, but it's also because of the condition that the lapse is just a function of T, this is also just a function of T. So actually, this could be written as the gradient of some other scalar. So in other words, U is just an exact form. It's a gradient of a scalar function, because basically this is, I guess, related to the lapse where And so it's just a function of t, so it's a function of t times a gradient of t, so it's a gradient of some function of t. So this fact tells us that the normal to the t equals constant surfaces follow geodesics. And the argument, I don't know, maybe I think you didn't even give the argument, it was so simple, but let me just say it. So let's compute the acceleration of this vector, VA, okay. So, but UA is the gradient of a scalar, so we have the gradient of the gradient of a scalar, and by the commutivity of those derivatives, I can just switch these two indices. Because U is the gradient of a scalar, this is UB spread A UB. But now, because UB is a unit vector, this is zero because it's just equal to the gradient of the norm of U. The norm of U is one, so this is zero. So actually, the acceleration of the unit normal to the t equals constant surfaces is zero. This is the projectable case, if I can keep that straight, that I'm talking about. So in that case, we have to, if we have a solution that describes a star and it has in it somehow this foliation of preferred surfaces, we have to find that foliation, presumably it's spherically symmetric, so that the normals are geodesics. But there's the problem with that. Because if this is the center of the star, and here's our some point, let's say here's the world tube of the star. So there's some normal U at this point in space-time, and we just integrate the geodesic with this initial condition. Given that the star creates a gravitational field, the geodesic will fall in that field. So it just will fall towards the center. But then it has to do something. If it goes back out through the other side, on the other side, it will disagree with the unit vector that I had on this side. It's just there isn't a stationary field of U's that I can even write down. I could start with an initial value slice and launch my U's everywhere there, and then they'd all fall in, and they'd cross each other, and I would have caustics. So anyway, looking at it in more detail at the actual field equations, Shinji concluded that there's no regular solution. So then he said, well, maybe it's somehow oscillating or accreting or I don't know what, but it looks really dangerous. We can't even make a star that's static in this theory. So on the other hand, I guess that conclusion has changed, for instance, if these pin over n squared term, which is the acceleration squared term, is added to the action, then, wait a minute. Yeah, and so we drop the projectable assumption, then we don't have this problem. So this looks like a possibly really bad thing about the projectable case. Okay.
So if I may, yes. I make a comment. So those terms, what they do is they make it, they give a finite speed of sound, the gradient term for Laplace. They give a finite speed of sound to the scalar world.
Yeah.
And the non-projectable version without those terms is the incompressible version of that when the speed of sound goes to infinity. So in principle, at least in the limit, if you're happy with having those gradient terms, the original non-projectable version is essentially having that sound waves and letting them decouple from everything else. That's the incompressible thing. I mean, that picture may not work at the nonlinear level. That's the point of disagreement between us.
Yeah, actually, I think I may have figured out what
okay.
is leading to that disagreement. And now I changed my mind. I think you may have made an error, which I'll now reveal. but actually, yeah, Calvin. Okay, so
I have a comment about the non-static stuff. So I think that I'm not sure whether it is really a problem or not, because for example, I mean, even in our universe, in GR plus GDM, dark matter is accreting towards our aging stars or sun. But we don't see. We have no problem, right? So similarly, even though the unit vector is accreting, there may be, I don't know whether it is a problem or not.
So,
because theory is, you have to specify the solution in Kozyrov theory, you have to specify geometry and correlation. And that's why it looks, non-static. From the point of view of low energy observer, it may still look like static, approximately. And I don't know whether
this is the scenario where the detailed structure of the T equals constant surfaces is very complicated, and it's like we're immersed in a gas of caustigons, right? And you're saying maybe we just didn't notice.
Right, maybe.
Okay.
I just don't know.
If you could spell that out in a little more detail, that would be great. In time for the next meeting.
Is there a problem with rotation as well? You have hyper surface with time everywhere in unit G does it.
It's not, no, it's the same problem because you could always choose any initial surface and then launch the geodesics from there.
The stationary is okay.
Well, it's just that the geodesics will form caustics and then we need to, well, actually they won't. You'll get strong curvature effects at small scale, somehow resolving, making the geodesics, according to Shinji's vision of reality, the geodesics that would have formed a caustic would actually encounter, just when they're about to do that, the higher derivative terms in the action would become important, there'd be a repulsive gravity effect, and the geodesics, still as geodesics, will sort of have to avoid crossing. So we'd be immersed now in some tangle of such geodesics that always avoided crossing. Is that what you're claiming?
Yeah. So did real life geometry is based on static?
Well, he's saying there could be, well, we know, you mean like, could that be compatible with this picture? Is that what you're asking? I think he's saying it may be if you coarse grain over small scale structure.
But it's really the exact opposite. It's not a static, but the coarse grain version might be a static. That's the whole. The fine grain one is not.
Yeah.
Enough.
Okay.
So the coarse grain ones, we're not following geodesics anymore?
No. Well, who knows? Hopefully, that's the whole. Yeah.
Well, there's a coarse-grained gravitational field. It's not so much a coarse-grained geodesics or foliation. It's a coarse-grained. There's no longer a link, as I understand it, between the foliation and having its normal speed geodesic.
And also, you have to make sure that at these very very high energies, the classical computation is okay. The sun coupling problem is precisely the fact that there will be quantum effects that will,
right,
will be important in this case. You cannot really say much. You can hope, but not really calculate.
Yeah. Right, I think, maybe I should say, so Shinji is not just purely fantasizing. I mean, he did a calculation, which he didn't really tell us much about, of caustic avoidance in a situation with a kind of planar caustic, co-dimension one caustic, which actually did avoid caustic formation. I don't know if you thought about whether the classical calculation was actually reliable in that example.
Honestly speaking, I don't know. I mean, so that if lambda is exactly one, there is no way to avoid planar caustic. And So we have to consider lambda, an indication from, of lambda from 1. But that must be a quantum. So, so we have to take, take into account some algebra, in the analysis. But so my analysis is kind of, I set lambda not equal 1 by hand, and show that planar caustics can be avoided. But in reality, we have to take it around the algebra. It's not easy.
Okay. Maybe I should come to this disagreement between Nyash's analysis of the scalar mode and what Diego was talking about. That doesn't go up. So this is, I think there may be just an elementary error. So Nyash was inviting us to look at this term in the Lagrangian. And his claim was something like k is fixed by boundary conditions to be constant on the preferred foliation. Is that a correct statement?
Yes.
Okay. So the argument went something like this. He's going to introduce an auxiliary field. So first of all, K can be written as the divergence of this unit vector field that I just mentioned. So here is K. Twice K minus times phi minus phi squared. It's going to replace this by that. I'm just leaving off lambda. Varying phi, we get the equation of motion that says phi is actually equal to the divergence of u, which is k. But then he's going to basically make a trick. So he's going to integrate by parts in this action here, and replace this by minus 2 u mu grad mu of phi. And then remember that u was actually the gradient of a function divided by the norm. So putting that in, minus 2 gradient u of psi over, I think he called it psi, so I'll call it psi, d alpha psi. Right, and use phi times phi squared. And then he said, okay, now we're supposed to vary the things in the action, so but instead of varying the phi first, I'll vary the psi. So varying psi in this action, he got an equation for phi, which said that the divergence of the spatial part of this gradient times the square root of the determinant of the metric and a factor of this is 0. So we've got an equation which definitely implied that, and I believe that it did imply, that phi is actually purely a function of psi. Or, yeah, you could say that. So the claim is, and I think it's true, variation of psi equation implies that phi equals just a function of psi.
Particular frame.
Well, though psi was the function that defined the preferred foliation, phi, by the other equation of motion, is k. So he shows this argument were correct, would show that k is just a function of the preferred time, so it's constant on the preferred slices. Okay. Now, here's what I think is wrong. When you make variational principles, if you vary a field, you have to vary it everywhere it appears in the action. And this is not the only place in the theory that the U field appears. Now, in fact, in a way, the U field doesn't appear anywhere. right? We start with the metric and the preferred time and so forth. But if we choose to write things a different way, part of the metric information is encoded in the way the normal vector field comes about, normal to the surfaces of constant metric. So the point is that, I think the point is that it's just completely, it's just inconsistent to vary this psi here and not vary, in effect, vary it in the other parts of the Lagrangian that I didn't even write it down.
But those are diffeomorphism invariant. Those are foliation invariant. So that's the Einstein-Hilbert. The Einstein-Hilbert part is foliation invariant. So it doesn't depend on psi by construction. Now, there are high derivative terms, so those may change things, but you wouldn't expect things high.
Well, in any case, the disagreement was just in the... okay, so that's the last step in the argument, is that everything else in the action, the other k squared, k b squared, k squared, and Ricci scalar of the spatial geometry...
Don't depend on psi.
...really just are the Ricci, four-dimensional Ricci scalar integrated over
exactly.
Space-time. And this variation of psi is a coordinate change in that action.
Exactly.
And therefore, this is the whole psi variation.
Yeah. As long as you ignore the higher derivative
parts
of the spatial.
Yeah. Okay.
As long as you don't.
Now I'm back to agreeing with you.
Perfect.
Can I make a comment? Because
yes.
It's too good. But okay, you don't agree with
okay. First one.
I will draw. Okay. What you really find is that psi or phi is a function of time. Okay. You agree with that?
In the preferred which is the psi as psi. So phi.
But then that means that I can split this into phi being a function of phi dot, would it lie in a function of psi? Okay. Do you agree with that?
No.
Why not? I mean, my only point is that this is not the only solution with given the boundary conditions that you impose. And the other solutions are indeed the solutions of the equation of motion of first order that we find. So we see we solve the problem in both gauges, both in the covariant gauge and in the unitary gauge, and in both of them we find an extra degree of freedom.
But locally, there is an exception, so that's why the boundary conditions are important. But
look, but the degree of freedom is not in this file. The degree of freedom is in the metric. So I agree that here there is not an extra degree of freedom.
But we completely decoupled metric from psi. I mean, the metric has its own degrees of freedom.
Here, go and study the metric degrees of freedom. There is an extra degree of freedom.
Yes, okay. So there is a disagreement there.
We'll do it after
this. Actually, for those of you that didn't hear it, this discussion has been going on now for an integrated time of about 2 hours, and they still haven't come to agreement about it. So.
But you agree with me, right?
I agree with you. I just don't agree with the last step. And I think that the reason is very simple.
All right. Well,
nobody takes a word.
Diego. Okay, yeah. Let me say it another way. Covariantizing something is not a unitary operation. I mean, there are many ways of covariantizing something. So you have something in a particular gauge, and you want to find a covariant expression for it, and you are giving it in a particular way. And I'm telling you another way of covariantizing it with an extra function which is free. Okay.
It's already covariant.
Sorry?
It's already covariant.
Before. The only thing you know from the solution is it's a function of time, right? And then you covariantize saying, well, as I can identify t as psi, is that a possible covariant way? Yeah, I agree with that. But I am telling you that you can covariantize it also saying that this is a function of psi and derivative of, I should write it.
You want to write it?
Yeah. Well, sorry. Because I think that's where we really agree. If this happens, you see? This is telling you, and this is an equation, a differential equation of first order. Once you go to this frame, to this
if you go back here, the only thing this is telling you is that psi is a function of time. That is covariant, and perfect. I may be wrong, but that's the only way I see that we can match.
No, but that has a Laplace function in it.
No, it doesn't. It is not you, it's the derivative.
But I mean, you use the metric to raise that, so there's a Laplace function. So that's not equivalent to the one downstairs.
Okay, still, I have to think
about it. But
hopefully you'll.
But Diego, you agree, if you, in your formalism, pick a particular gauge, you end up with a set of equations that look like Nyash's in the limit that M prime goes to infinity.
Yes, yes.
And in that limit, you agree with him. But what you're saying is that if M prime is finite, if you take into account the higher order stuff that's in Petter's theory, then you don't end up with grad k equals zero.
Yes.
There's a small contribution, and then you, many steps down the road, you get into an argument that's strong coupling. But as a set of equations, you agree in this particular limit. It's just how you interpret the results.
No, I don't think that was the point of disagreement. I thought that all the disagreement was about this k squared term, the higher derivative.
You try and phrase the disagreement in terms of what's on the board, if I look at what he was writing and what we were discussing, I think it reduces down to that statement.
Yeah, maybe.
There's a set of equations that you guys agree on, but then you have this extension.
That's why we prefer to solve everything in a particular gauge and not doing a covariantization or something we don't know how to do. Maybe we should finish the discussion at some point or die.
Hopefully that will sort out the question. Next topic.
So this story also changes if you add your term, not this.
This story is fixed here, we are.
You disagree.
Sorry,
the gradient of M, we are there.
Well, then the degree of freedom is perfect.
But I think this is the point.
But this last equation, when you are in specific.
So in this limit, if that term is not there, you have an exactly non-dynamical field, or the scalar degree of freedom. If you add that term, then it's not that it becomes dynamical. It has a finite speed of sound. It propagates. Letting the coefficient of that term go to zero makes the speed of sound go to infinity. So exactly decouples the scalar mode from everything else.
I suggest, since this disagreement has been going on for a while, we might want to return to it in the extra session after the end of the conference.
Okay. All right, let me go to the next topic. A couple of remarks about stability of the theory from a non-perturbative and even one from not even a classical point of view. So more on stability. Both of these are going to refer actually to the projectable case. So in motivating, and they both relate to Shinji's idea about the dark matter without dark matter. He pointed out that for a Friedman-Robertson-Walker cosmology, if you drop the Hamiltonian constraint, which is the Friedman equation, H squared equals energy density, then you almost get it back for free, but not quite. And that's because if we have the conservation law for the matter, we have the dynamical equation. So he inferred that you'd have something that looks like some amount of either positive or negative mass pressureless dust. But this raises the idea that if the scalar constraint is dropped, and we have a preferred time in this theory, then as far as I can see, doesn't that mean that we have a true Hamiltonian and we don't have the usual problem of time that you have in quantum gravity? So there's no problem of time. No quote, problem of time. Now, people trying to understand the problem of time like to study FRW quantum gravity, otherwise known as mini superspace quantum gravity.
Is it also true that there's no stability because the proof of the ABM mass being done from below requires that you be on the
I'm going to get to that as the next topic.
Okay.
But just considering this, you're going to be surprised. So as I was saying, so it's a tradition, a long tradition, to study mini superspace quantum cosmology to try to actually understand the problem of time. But how about here, studying mini superspace Lipschitz gravity? We now have a Hamiltonian. We have a time. What's the spectrum of the Hamiltonian? It's a quantum mechanical system. I mean, I haven't tried to look at it, but it looks like you should be able to just study this quantum system and first and see if the spectrum of this Hamiltonian is bounded below.
Just one small comment that there is still the integrated Hamiltonian constraint. So if you go to mini superspace, you can of course play games and say, what if I, for example, drop the lattice function completely and set it equal to one and have no reparametrization of time? And then you would have a true Hamiltonian that actually has eigenvalues.
Well, if I took compact spatial.
But if you have the global constraint, which is associated with these.
Well, then I still have a constraint. Yeah, that's true. So, which is as good as the.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. So the idea was really.
No, it is interesting to consider the possibility of dropping the reparametrization.
Okay, so then it would have to be. So the way should you use this to motivate the non FRW case was to just say locally in our part of space time, if all we have is the integrated constraint, it's as if we didn't have the constraint. Therefore, it's like doing this, dropping the scalar constraint in the FRW case. It's supposed to be a model of that. Okay, so I guess it has to be regarded that way, but you're right. It's really not a, well, anyway, it's mini superspace. Let me take up Lee's question now about what about the positive energy theorem in this kind of gravity? So classically, what about the classical positive energy theorem? So in view of the kind of instabilities that we've heard about, you might think, oh yeah, it's not going to be stable, and anyway, the usual theorem proof breaks down because you don't have the scalar constraint, and that plays a crucial role in proving it. But actually, if you think about it, it seems like actually the proof goes through, and you can prove it. So I'll explain why I say that now. This is all, you know, very half-baked. I may have just made another dumb error, and one of you will point it out quickly. But so the ABM energy is some surface integral at spatial infinity. So I'm going to consider now this asymptotically flat case. So the ABM energy is a spatial boundary integral. And then by integrating that or writing it as a volume integral, that can be written as an integral over a surface, Cauchy surface. And the way the integral looks is it's something like the 0 mu Einstein tensor minus the 0 mu stress energy tensor plus something I'll just call J mu, but some integrand that has this structure integrated over the surface. Then by the usual Einstein equations or the initial value constraints, which say that this is 0, we don't have to worry about that part. And by Witten's cleverness, choosing the lapse and shift function that defined the surface, he could show that the contraction, let's write this as some normal vector, n du times d3 sigma, we could show that j mu, mu greater than or equal to 0 can be arranged. This is the Witten proof of the positive energy theorem. So that's the structure of the proof. He writes it as something that's 0 by the constraints and something that can be arranged to be non-negative by choosing lapse and shift to satisfy a certain equation. Okay. Uh-oh, I think I may have just seen a flaw in my argument. Okay, so Shinji tells us that when we don't have this constraint, this is not equal to zero, but it's equal to the zero mu component of the Hurwitz-Lipschitz dark matter without dark matter stress energy. And moreover, he tells us the form of this thing. It's some rho, some energy density, times something that looks like dust, where u is the same old u that we've been talking about, the normal to the preferred surfaces. Now, what I was going to argue is if I take this slice that I'm evaluating this integral on to be the preferred slicing, then from this term, what I get is just the integral of rho HL d3 sigma.
D sigma is a time lag or a space lag?
I'm taking a space-like surface.
That's
the volume element of that is d3. And this was the normal vector to that. And I guess if I choose n mu equal to u mu, then this knot is also referring to n mu. So I just project out rho. I just have the integral of rho. But the constraint that Shinji explained to us, actually, the integral constraint is precisely that this is zero. So although this by itself is not zero, this integrand, the integral of it is zero. On the other hand, what about this term? Now, the arrangement to have this satisfied actually required choosing, that's right, now I can do this just fine. I can choose whatever surface I want in the Witten argument. It's just that the lapse and shift have to be chosen to arise from the solution to this elliptic differential equation for a spinner field. At that surface, I'm sort of moving off the surface in Witten's directions such that this contraction would be non-negative. So I simply choose that surface, like I said, to control this term to be the one that's the preferred surface in the theory. And then I use Witten's argument, still applies here. So it seems like if I just proved
the lapse term is the approximate time that's the place.
A function of position is the problem.
Yeah, that's
you just there you go.
But could you say that again?
Yeah, so it's true that I can find Witten's lapse and shift, but I don't have much choice over it. And in particular, the lapse will end up being a function of position on the slice. But I said I was talking about the projectable theory. In fact, I used that. Let's see, I used that when I made this argument that this difference had this form with this integral being zero. So, okay, it has to be thought about more carefully.
Is there anything that stops you from just arbitrarily changing coordinates and not respecting the foliation? Even though there is a preferred foliation, you could say, I'm just trying to prove that a certain term is positive definite, and I can choose any coordinates which you are. And I just cross.
Sure, but this term I seem to have control over in the preferred coordinate.
You say you have to treat both terms in the same coordinate?
Well, actually, here I'm choosing, there's two things. There's choosing the slice. Is that choosing coordinates?
Not really. That's what I mean. What if you choose a slicing which does not match the preferred slice?
Then I would not have control over this sign.
But that was argued separately to be already zero by the in the preferred slice. In other words, I'm saying perhaps we can choose different foliations for proving the positivity.
If you had a divergenceless current, then yeah, you could shift the surface. But I don't know, but I don't think that difference is divergenceless. Although actually, Shinji, you said that the divergence of the difference, the dark stress tensor by itself is zero if you don't have the higher derivative terms. Is that what
you're also, lambda must be one.
And if lambda is exactly
also one. The matter energy, I mean, matter T menu must satisfy conservation law.
Yeah, so there are a lot of, okay, so this needs more thought. I just, let me put it out as a direction to look at. Maybe you could prove a positive energy.
Yeah. One comment on this, and that's if you don't particularly insist on picking lambda equal to 1 or close to 1, so let's not worry about phenomenology, but this looks just like a gravity system for all values of lambda which are smaller than 1 over d, including the entire range all the way to minus infinity. If you look at the Hamiltonian, it is manifestly positive, definitely. So there's no issue of possible violations of positive definiteness of the energy. At least classically, you have a manifestly positive definite Hamiltonian.
Less than 1 over d.
Right. So you can't.
Oh, yeah, because the trace part of
the. Essentially, basically, as long as you are in the a value of lambda which gives you a debit metric which doesn't have negative eigenvalues, then the Hamiltonian happens to be, at least in the case of detailed balance, because you have a Hamiltonian which is a perfect square.
But that's not. That doesn't even include the GR case.
Oh, it does, because you can rewrite the Hamiltonian as the spatial part of the Hamiltonian is the Cotton tensor plus the Einstein tensor plus the cosmological constant term squared. And you're squaring using the positive definite Debye metric on that side, so the Hamiltonian is manifestly positive definite, even though you might end up for the wrong choice of the sign in front of the scalar curvature. You might generate the wrong sign in the term. At low energies, so determine the 3 plus 1 action would actually have instabilities if you try to expand in near flat space. There is a guarantee that there should be a ground state, which is probably spatially modulated. So then the instability near the flat space is really an artifact of expanding around a solution which is more like a maximum rather than a minimum of the energy. The local maximum, you see the instability by seeing modes which represent that instability already at the particular level, but there is a ground state which is probably going to be very curved in some dimensions. So actually that reminds me of your suggestion that we should take the existence of this room seriously. And of course I agree that we should be, if we want to make any contact with realistic gravity in Z plus 1, we need to reproduce a flat space as a reasonably stable solution. The idea is that perhaps these spatially modulated phases should be really viewed in higher dimensions. If you start, let's say, in 4 plus 1 dimensions, if you have a spatially modulated, this is of course just a dream, I don't really have a solution that represents this, but if you have a spatially modulated phase on one dimension, you can still imagine that just like in condensed matter, in some simple cases, it leads to a phase which is kind of foliated by lower dimensional slices. So the decrease of freedom will behave in a different way along the leaves compared to the direction along which the solution is modulated. So the dream scenario in that case would be to start in 4 plus 1 dimensions, find a spatially modulated phase, and try to show that it actually represents a 3 plus 1 dimensional non-compact kind of geometry.
I'm not trying to say anything, but have you just lost the equivalence principle? That is, if you have a form of the energy for the gravitational field, which is an integral over of something squared, which is positive definite, that means that there is a local gravitational energy, and you no longer have the equivalence principle. You no longer need to go into a freely flowing frame and not measure the gravitation.
And of course, this, as I was saying, this is only for the values of lambda, which are very far from GR.
So you have lost.
At the theoretical level, the Hamiltonian, if you take the regime where lambda is smaller than 1 over the dimension of space, the Hamiltonian happens to be manifestly positive definite. But I have nothing really conclusive to say about the more interesting terminological set of values of lambda.
Okay, I understand.
Okay, I guess I'm actually over my time. I do have two more topics I wanted to mention. I'll make them brief. A big issue that was discussed in several respects is the problem of, or the question of, recovering Lorentz symmetry in the infrared. And you can look at RG flow of Lorentz violating couplings, We heard that the flow, you know, might push towards Lorentz invariance, but not quickly enough to account for low energy Lorentz invariance. Peter mentioned the idea of supergravity or supersymmetry, some other symmetry, forcing somehow all particles to come up in the same, with the same low energy speeds. That's a scary thought, but I also had it. I mean, have you thought about Aravalicious supergravity? Could you imagine how to even start writing it, and then you would need the matter to be transforming in the same, under the same supersymmetry algebra to even have any hope? It's a scary thought, but I see the motivation.
Right. We have thought about it, and there is a draft of some first step. No gravity, just the supersymmetry in field theory. Because of course the issue is that if you start with something which is highly anisotropic in the UV, then already the supersymmetry algebra is not going to be the conventional Poincaré algebra, so the Poincaré algebra. But we can show, and this is work with Charles, who's probably here somewhere. We can show in simple examples in field theory with scalar fields and perhaps with a vector field, but not necessarily for gravity yet. We can start with a theory which is UV supersymmetric under a very non-Poincaré supersymmetry algebra, where essentially supercharges squared to the time translations. There's no participation by the spatial translations in the superalgebra. And then you can actually see that you cannot turn on relevant deformations in the theory, which would preserve the same algebra in the infrared, but you can turn on relevant deformations which deform the superalgebra to the superPoincaré. So in some sense, in some cases, not including gravity, we can show we get the superPoincaré algebra, and then all the fields are in the same supermultiplied of the conventional superPoincaré symmetry. They would have the same speed of light by the symmetry in the infrared. But supergravity seems very difficult.
Yeah. Maxim, do you want to comment on that idea?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know how difficult it would be to have it in super gravity, but the general idea that we published many years ago, if you have, let's say, MSSM spectrum, right, and you insist on regular global supersymmetry on MSSM kind of gauge invariance, all your Lorentz non-invariant operators start from dimension 5, which means that, you know, there will be no problem from radiative corrections to generating different speeds of lights.
I wasn't particularly trying to be phenomenologically viable here. I'm just answering the question of whether at the theoretical level there is any work on making the supersymmetry. Yeah. I was just mentioning it.
Yeah, I think it's the point is there is
a possibility of asymmetry that might perhaps do this, but I'm not saying that this is my favorite by any stretch of it.
I think Maxim's agreeing. It's just that he already looked at Lorentz violating supersymmetric field theory in a different type of Lorentz violating, I think. And his supersymmetry algebra did. It contain all the translations.
I just took the very, you know, conservative, the same supersymmetry algebra as usual, the same gauge invariance, everything is the same, and you can just show that the expansion for any possible Lorentz violating operator starts at dimension 5 of the level, and moreover, it doesn't grow in the ultraviolet. And so this is the case of relatively safe Lorentz violation.
Right.
And the other comment is that, you know, people who play with supergravity and enough supersymmetries find that it's finite to many loops. So if you go to supergravity, maybe everything is fine. It's just naive. But
I want to make a very vague but physical comment about the idea of what could produce a common speed emerging at low energies. And that's just, I guess this is probably obvious to everybody that does these renormalization group calculations, but nobody sort of says it in this simple-minded physical terms. So maybe I'm just confused, or maybe it's useful to think about. Namely, simply that if I have a strong coupling scale somewhere, and let's say if I have gravity that's going to be strongly coupled at the Planck scale, then whatever Lorentz violation I might have above that scale, all types, all species talk to each other through the intermediary of gravity strongly at that scale. So it's like a big, you know, tug of war where all the fields are strongly coupled to each other. And it just sort of makes absolutely no sense in that strongly coupled regime to have fields which maintain different light cones as far as I can see. Or if you think about it in the language of algebraic quantum field theory, you know, a given field's light cone is defined by the region in space-time where its field operators commute or don't commute. I'm talking about microcausality. But if the field operator is dressed with the field operators of all the other fields through the gravitational interaction, then there can't really be any disagreement about where the causal cone is. So in a sort of general sense, it seems like the recipe for universality at low energies is just something up there that's very strongly coupled, and gravity can always do the job. So I thought this was a really good idea until somebody pointed out to me there is a sort of, it doesn't do the job enough. And I'll just state this counter argument. Maybe one of you can get around it. But the statement would be, you know, if we're considering a Lorentz violating theory up at this high scale, kinetic terms, so to speak, or propagation is not the only thing that violates Lorentz. I mean, let's say all the interaction terms in principle do as well. So let's say that this strongly coupled regime managed to, you know, whip everybody into shape to advance to the same metric at the cutoff scale, at the strong coupling scale. But then there are still these Lorentz violating operators at that scale, which, you know, are small, let's say maybe suppressed by their higher dimension operators maybe, or not. But anyway, they're there. They're not kinetic operators, like interactions. And then if you just run down from that scale to the low energy theory, without any protection on the way, you'll sort of regain non-universal coupling to the metric just because of the presence of those interaction terms. So then it seems like the only way to make this scenario work would be if you could somehow kill off anything but the kinetic type Lorentz violation, which doesn't make too much sense to me. So this is a really half-baked idea, not even half. It's a 1 over n baked idea.
Yeah, so just an obvious comment. What you want is for this scale which defines the strong coupling regime not just to be universal among the interactions, but to be observer independent, so that observers in different Lorentz frames related by Boole's agreed on what that scale is. And what you can imagine following is the idea of deforming the action of the Lorentz transformations so that everybody agrees about what the strong coupling scale is. Mm-hmm. And then that would protect you all the way down.
I'll believe it when I see it. Okay, can I end then? One more topic, finally, and nobody mentioned this, but it is, I think, maybe relevant to the same question about the multiple speeds. So there's this strange, if we had, suppose that it didn't work out, and down at the low energy in the IR, we had multiple limiting speeds for different fields. Then, as pointed out by Dubofsky and Sviryakov, we have a strange thing happening with black hole thermodynamics. We seem to have a problem with the second law of thermodynamics. They pointed out that if you had two species of fields that propagate with different limiting speeds in the vacuum, so there's no medium here floating around, then you could extract energy from a black hole, or you could violate the second law. And I want to give a simple argument. They use the Hawking radiation to do it, arranging for, okay, I won't go into that. I want to keep this brief. But my students and I came up with a strictly classical version of the argument that's simpler to think about and harder to see how you could get out of it. And the argument goes like this. Let's say we have two species of particles, A particles and B particles. And these are slower, so these are the slow ones and these are the fast ones. in terms of their limiting speeds. And now let's say we have a black hole, and there's the horizon. But that's the horizon for the A particles. The B particles go faster, so they can get out from there. So inside the A horizon, I have a B horizon.
Okay.
Yes.
How do you define your horizon? Is it a group? I mean, now you have, I mean, group velocity, phase velocity, I mean.
Just the limiting speed of any influence, let's say.
The escape velocity of A particles versus B particles, right?
Yeah. It's probably really defined by the energy and momentum ratios, if I think about it carefully, but let me not think about it. Okay, so we know that with an ordinary black hole, so the usual Penrose process, which allows you to extract energy from a rotating black hole, works because there's an ergo region outside the black hole where the time translation Hilling vector is space-like, which means that you can have negative energy states. So Penrose's original process was to actually lower particles on a rope into negative energy states inside the ergo region. And as the rope goes down past the boundary of the ergo region, it starts, you know, the not only all the rest mass of the particle can be extracted at the other end of the rope at infinity, but even more energy can be extracted, which is some of the mass of the black hole. And people know the Penrose process mostly by this particle goes into the ergo region and breaks into two pieces, but actually Penrose's original introduction was to lower a rope into the ergo region. You can see in his 1969 paper on gravitational collapse. So similarly here, we want to lower a particle on a rope into past the horizon. The rope is going to be a B rope because I have to be able to pull it back out. At the end of the B rope is an A particle, or a box full of A radiation, let's say. It's an A particle. So the region inside here is an ergo region for A particles. A particles have negative energy states inside the A horizon. So just by lowering this rope, I can actually extract more than the rest energy of the A particle as work at infinity. And therefore, I can get the rest energy of the black hole out. I could take a box of A radiation with a lot of entropy, just heat, lower it down, and extract it as useful work at infinity. So in that sense, I'm violating the second law. And well, what could be wrong with this? One thing that could be wrong with it is that, actually, I really shouldn't go on, but so we considered ways, things that might be wrong with this contraption and argued that you could make it work despite those issues. And so I'll just say the point I'm trying to make is that maybe actually there's some even deeper thermodynamic reason why whatever the microscopic theory is, it's going to always manage for some reason that we haven't really understood yet, related to quantum gravity, to ease itself into the universal metric ground state in the IR, because if it didn't, it would violate the second law of thermodynamics. And the mechanism by which it does that, you know, this doesn't tell us anything about, but it's an argument that it must happen. So that's all I'm going
to
say.
So related to that, so as you know very well, the Isis equation can be interpreted in thermodynamical. So it would be interesting to see whether these new terms can have a thermodynamical interpretation.
Additional questions?